You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the children's program for reluctant adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On last month's show, we celebrated our local independent publishers and the authors whose work they publish with Dan Armstrong of Eugene's Mud City Press, Kathleen McFall and Clark Hayes of Portland's Pump Jack Press, and Bobby Eversman, editor-in-chief at Deep Overstock, a book publisher and literary journal also based in Portland. For today's show, we celebrate another local literary luminary, Joshua Samuel Brown, author of the debut novel Spinning Karma, published by a not-so-local indie publisher, Camphor Press. We've talked with Josh twice before on KBOO, the first time for his book of travel stories, How Not to Avoid Jet Lag and Other Tales of Travel Madness, and most recently, just about this time last year, for Formosa Moon, a hybrid travel guide and memoir, co-authored by Josh's partner, Stephanie Huffman. Along with Yorick Jones, no relation, Josh and Stephanie also wrote, performed, and produced the legendary radio comedy show Puppet Radio Theater on KBOO. We'll be talking about Josh's experiences as a travel writer and Buddhist practitioner, his love of Taiwan, the ongoing war between spin and facts, why writing a book that mirrors the not-too-distant political climate can be problematic, and of course his very funny and moving new novel, Spinning Karma. In the words of comedian Eddie Pepitone, also known as the Bitter Buddha, I heartily recommend this cynical and funny book. If you don't read Spinning Karma, the winds of change may destroy your serenity. Great book. Joshua Samuel Brown, welcome back to the neighborhood.
It's always good to be back. Thank you, Ken.
Now, Josh, this is the third time we've talked for the radio, the first for your book of travel stories, How Not to Avoid Jet Lag and Other Tales of Travel Madness.
Which I just admitted on Goodreads that I actually neither read nor wrote. I've credited that entire book to my former assistant, Felipe.
Felipe's a bad interview, so I'm not going to talk with
him. He's currently in jail in Brunei, so it's a long story.
Okay, maybe that will be a second book.
Maybe,
Well, the second time we talked was for the book you wrote with your partner, Stephanie Huffman. That was Formosa Moon, and you guys were phoning in from Taiwan. I remember Stephanie was at home. You were outside in an alley in the summer heat trying to get some kind of cell phone reception.
I was in an alley, and I remember I was there, and somebody was like drying blocks of tofu. And the only place that I could get both out of the heat and good reception was in that alley. And they were looking at me like I was going to steal their tofu. And I was like, no, I'm not going to steal it. It was too hard to explain in the heat. And I was just like, it's okay. And so I backed away. That was a very unique interview.
That's a good thing, because it doesn't get any lower than a tofu thief.
No, it does not. In fact, there's probably a Chinese saying about that that I don't know about.
Right. Well, anyway, let's start with Taiwan, which plays a big role in the new novel, as well as your previous travel books. And then you had a book of short stories, Vignettes of Taiwan, that came out in 2006. Now, it's an independent country, officially named the Republic of China, and it's not to be confused with the People's Republic of China, which we call that mainland China.
So which is easy to confuse that, but in Taiwan, they don't call the mainland the mainland. They call it China. They call Taiwan Taiwan.
Oh, okay. So I won't ask you to go into the very complicated history of the island, but clearly it's a place very close to your heart. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your experience in Taiwan and its attraction for you.
A good friend of mine once said that Taiwan is where people who had bad childhoods go for a do-over. And so you see a lot of, it's a very welcoming place. People are generally very friendly there. And I went there when I was 24 years old, I was a few years out of university and had been sort of bouncing around the country I moved to Seattle, and then I moved to Vermont, and I lived in Rochester, and I was like trying to find myself. I was like, okay, I'm going to go overseas and I'm going to teach English, and I'm going to do that for 2 years because that's the thing to do. Everybody at that point in the early 90s, let's go to Japan and make money. But I did not go to Japan because I had the good fortune of being in a restaurant owned by a Taiwanese woman, but I did not know this at the time. And she saw that I was reading a book called Teach English in Japan. And she, as she was refilling my tea, she made a derisive remark, which I did not understand at the time. She said, "Jumankwe," which means Japanese devils. And she then very subtly moved the book to the far end of the table. And she said, "You know, you should not go to Japan because they will not be so nice to you there. Why don't you go to Taiwan? That's where I'm from." And I had not thought about it before. I knew vaguely about Taiwan. I knew a little bit about, you know, what you hear on CNN, and still do, although not so much, thankfully, that Taiwan split from China in 1949 and China will still use force to retake Taiwan. That's all that I knew about it, and that they had been under martial law. But in any event, she was very serious about this, and she said, "You should come back in a couple of days and I'll get some information for you." And I came back, and she had, like, this is before the internet, she had had somebody fax her all of these job listings from, I think it must have been the China Post, which, and again, China, Taiwan. The China Post was a Taiwanese English language newspaper. I worked for it for years later, but I don't think it exists anymore. But it was all these ads, and she was like, "Oh, these are some schools close to where my family lives. If you want, I'll call for you, and I will, you know, like let them know that you're a good guy." And she did, and I called up, like, "Oh, yes, my auntie says that you're a nice person and that you have a degree in English from a school close to Rochester. If you come here, we'll give you a job." So I said, "Okay." And, you know, I booked a plane ticket to Taiwan in 1994, and I went there. The idea was that I would stay there for 2 years and then move on, and I wound up staying there until 1999, when I got another job that sent me to China, and I traveled around. I was a factory inspector, but I kept coming back and forth to Taiwan. I would always wind up back there. And just over the years, I've just lived there on and off. The funny thing is that if I had stayed there during one period of time, I would have actually gotten what's called a permanent alien residency certificate, which means that I would live there, I would have full coverage, healthcare, and everything, and all that I would need to do is maintain some residency there, and I could stay there forever, and I could drive a taxi or do any job that I wanted. I didn't do that because all of my stayings there were for 2 years here, 3 years here, 2 years here, 1 year there, and then I started working for Lonely Planet, and then I was traveling all over the world, but I would always come back to Taiwan. And I've written all this nonfiction about Taiwan. I've written two guides for Lonely Planet about Taiwan. I don't even know how many stories about Taiwan I've written for various publications, but this is my first novel, and I wanted Taiwan to be, it's not the only setting, it's not just set in Taiwan. And some of my Taiwanese friends are like, "Oh, why didn't you set the whole thing in Taiwan?" Like, other parts take part in other places. The character, Rinpoche Schwartz, when the book starts, he knows no more about Taiwan than I did in 1992 or something.
Oh yeah, but I actually want to ask you about that, Josh. As you mentioned, it's your first published novel. It takes place mostly in Taiwan, but also Boulder, Colorado. That's one of the main settings.
It does take place in Boulder, Colorado, and I lived in Boulder, Colorado for some time.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. So Rinpoche Schwartz, who you mentioned, is the protagonist.
Yes.
And he teaches in Boulder at a fictional university, Bodhidharma U.
Bodhidharma University, yeah.
And that seems loosely based on the Naropa Institute, which is in Boulder. He also leads a very small religious group called the Mind of Pure Enlightenment.
Or MOPE.
And that's at a nearby hot springs. And you've lived and worked in Boulder. I wonder, did that include experience with Naropa and the local spiritual and wellness scene, which is quite prevalent?
When I lived in Boulder, Colorado, which was, I was there for Y2K, I came back from Asia. And I had some friends who live there, and they're like, "Oh, you should come and live in Colorado. It's nice here." And so I moved there, and this is when the internet was this new thing. And I had learned how to do web design. So I started a website called boulderhealing.net. And the idea was that I would build websites for holistic practitioners of all sorts. And we put them in one place so that this is way before Google. This is if you were searching online for somebody who did Reiki or who did acupuncture or who did massage, you name the modality, you would come to boulderhealing.net and you would then be able to see and then have their picture and, you know, my name is Reiki Master, whatever. And this is where I learn. This is where I practice. These are my modalities. I put some pictures of them in there. And again, this is back when the internet was this new, and it was a new and there wasn't really a script for how the internet worked. So I created this site and I got to be very, I don't want to say deeply involved, but superficially in a very wide way, but broadly involved with a wide segment of the massage practitioners and Reiki practitioners and reflexologists and acupuncturists all in and around Boulder, Colorado. And one thing that I took away from that when I started this company was that a lot of people who are in that industry don't have a lot of spare cash. And I wound up being paid largely in acupuncture and cranial sacral work and all sorts of other wonderful modalities. So for the year that I was running this company, I was super grounded and I was very healthy. Like I felt in great health, but I didn't have a lot of spare cash because
I was going to say you were like the healthiest pauper in town.
I had other writing gigs that I would do. And I actually lived in a shared house that the ashram is based on. So I believe that it's not the exact address, of course, but the ashram in my mind is based on this shared house that I shared with other, you know, 20 somethings in the hills outside of Boulder, Colorado that, you know, I had my room and other people had their rooms. And one of the guys was actually a cranial sacral therapist who had a room in the basement where he did cranial sacral work. And, you know, I obviously did something for him on Boulder Healing, which he paid me with several cranial sacral, you know, things. So yeah. And I loved Boulder. I liked living there, but there was at the time, and it's been years since I lived there, there was a joke, which is, if you throw a rock in Boulder, Colorado, you may not hit a massage therapist, but you'll definitely have somebody nearby who can come and Reiki the wound. And like, there's this sort of very special thing about Boulder that made it the natural place for Rinpoche Schwartz to wind up after the collapse of the sex cult from which he was, launched or spawned, if you will.
Now, I read that the initial spark for the story in Spinning Karma was a 10-day Buddhist meditation retreat.
Yes.
Not in Boulder, Colorado, but you did years earlier in Sri Lanka.
This was This was the Boulder, Colorado I lived in 99-2000. And this was a meditation retreat that I did approximately 10 years later in Sri Lanka at a place called Nilambe Meditation Retreat. I will send them a copy of the book. I hope that they forgive me. The story has nothing to do with them. The only thing is that I did this 10-day meditation retreat and it was beautiful. It was a wonderful place. And at one point there was a monk who I would watch and he was, I don't know if he was portly, but he was portly for a monk. And I noticed that when he would come in, he always got to sit in there's like a place of honor that the monks sit, which makes perfect sense. But also people would come and they would give him food. They would, in the meal times, they would come and they would give him food and he would bless them. And I got to thinking, I was like, how do you get your credentials checked for this? Like, how do I know that this isn't just some guy who's like, hey, I'm going to put on monk's robes. I'm going to go up to Nilambe. They're going to feed me. I'm going to be living great up there. And this is my own thing. This is what I was thinking when I was supposed to be meditating, examining the breath and everything. But I basically wrote a very early draft of what this story might be like. And I think I gave it a terrible name, which was Holy Moly.
That is pretty bad. Name. Yeah.
It's a terrible name. But the idea was somebody pretends to be a monk for some sort of gain, which of course happens in China, for example. You've been to China and you definitely have been approached as a Westerner in China by monks asking you for alms, right?
Well, I've been to Kathmandu and that's where I was approached the most.
And some of those people are monks, no doubt. Some of them probably are not. Some of them are like, oh, I put on the monk's robes and, you know, foreign tourists will give me money. This is a thing that that happens, you know, it happens everywhere, I'm sure. Not that in the East they corner the market on religious-based chicanery and shenanigans. We certainly have plenty of that here in our country. But that was the idea. And the story is completely different than that. It's the story has completely changed. But that was the original idea in Sri Lanka at a meditation retreat.
And you got a character out of it, Brother Manju, is also known as the Fat Buddha the book.
Except Brother Manju is... Yes, I never spoke to this monk. It was a silent retreat, so I did not approach this particular, probably a perfectly legitimate Sinhalese monk, probably. I didn't know. I didn't talk to him. But one of the first people who I interacted with as a university student who was, what's the word that I want to look at? He was a Sri Lankan guy, and he had come to America, and he worked, he was a student at the dance department at SUNY Brockport, and his name was also Manju, and he was Sri Lankan, and I guess he was my first Sri Lankan friend, certainly, but my first friend who had come from Asia and now lived in America and was exotic and really like, oh my God, this guy's from a culture totally different than I'm used to in America. And I'm from New York City, but this is something I've not experienced before. And because I really love this guy, Manju, I named him Manju. And I wrote him, I was like, I'm naming a character in my novel who's Sri Lankan after you. But there is another connection to that, which is that when, right after I did this meditation retreat, the first thing that you do after you're done with the meditation retreat, I think anybody does this, is you go to like Pizza Hut because you're eating like meditation food. And I was starving and I went down and I went to Pizza Hut and I ate food. And then there was like an internet bar next door. And I went there and I blogged on Snarky Tofu. So I blog on, that's my blog, Snarky Tofu. And I wrote all about Nalambe meditation retreat. And I even said, I've just gotten myself a room at the whatever, the Candy, K-A-N-D-Y, guest house. So I'll be writing tomorrow, you know. And that was, because I blog a lot, I did. And that night, it's like 9 o'clock at night. And I'm just like, you know, going through like carbohydrate, you know, whatever it is. We eat carbs after not eating them for a long time. There's a knock on the door and the guy says, ah, they're telephone for you. I was like, what? Who knows that I'm here? So I open the door and he hands me the phone and I say, hello. And I hear, madman, what are you doing in my country? And I'm like, who is this? Who do you think it is? It is Manju. And I'm like, how? I hadn't talked to him. I think we may have spoken, you know, 1994, 1995, but we lost contact. I'm like, how do you know that I'm here? He's like, because I read your blog, man. Look out the window. And I look out the windows. Do you see that school over there? That was my high school. And I was like, sure enough, yes, I see it. And so we talked for a while. And then we became friends again as adults. And we chatted, you know, since then. We've met up once or twice since then. But I felt that if I was creating a character who was Sri Lankan, who was a monk of, let's just say, interesting pedigree and leave it at that, I needed to honor my friend Manju by giving him a name that was worthwhile of that sort of intrigue.
Now, when we did our first interview, so that was back in 2015 for How Not to Avoid Jet Lag, you mentioned you were currently turning a screenplay with the title Spinning Karma into a novel, which is book before me now. And I think you started on the screenplay in 2010, so about 10 years ago. Why did you initially write the story as a movie, as a screenplay, rather than a novel or a nonfiction book?
Originally, my idea was that I liked the idea of writing a screenplay, and I liked the idea of doing a movie that could be filmed in Taiwan. And other people had other ideas, specifically the various people who I pitched the screenplay to. I went to the Willamette Writers, the thing that happens every year.
Oh, they have some kind of convention, don't they?
Yeah. I actually went one year with the finished screenplay in my hand, and I went to all the screenplay things, and I paid like, you know, you pay like $20 to pitch it. And
to an agent or a Hollywood producer?
All four people who I pitched it to gave me varying degrees of, you're insane if you think that anyone will ever make this movie. And they were like, yeah, this sounds funny. It sounds interesting. It's unique. But number one, we're not going to go to Taiwan to film a movie, which now, by the way, this was 2013 or 2012, 2013. Now I think that we could possibly get it done because Taiwan is much more hot. It's a hotter commodity, thanks in no small part to, you know, the little thing of them being the only country on the planet to have beat COVID. I think they get big brownie points for that. But also, at the time, they were like, if we make this, any movie studio that does this, that makes a film in Taiwan that clearly has some political, that is calling Taiwan a country on its own right and pointing out that this difference exists, they will immediately be blackballed by China, and every studio wants Chinese money, and so they wouldn't do it. In fact, one person was like, there's no way that this would ever be made. At that point, I put it aside for a while, and then I got involved in other things, and I did other Lonely Planet jobs and other things, and I put it aside. And then I kind of had it almost finished as a novel before I left to do Formosa Moon. It was pretty much, and it wasn't as good as it is now, but it was pretty much finished right around the end of 2016. And then, you remember what happened at the end of 2016? We were here.
There was an election.
What was that guy? I can't remember his name, but he was president for 4 years. It was really, really bad.
We call him the former guy, I think.
The former guy. Yeah. I like that. No problem. In any event, there is, you know, a very strong, it's not even a subplot. Part of the plot is that you have a ambitious Republican congresswoman who is trying to, get her political, who's trying to help her political star to rise during a center leftist Democrat administration, basically based on, at the time when I was writing it, the Obama administration or whoever was supposed to follow Obama. And once the guy, the former guy, got elected, that plot no longer made sense. Number one, that plot no longer made any sense. And number two, at the time I was like, yeah, I'm not in the mood to write this political comedy. Things have just gotten so incredibly dark that I can't even joke about this now. So I put it aside. I did Formosa Moon. And then right around the middle of, about the middle of 2019, I came back to the States and I really started tinkering with the novel. And I basically decided, okay, this is not going to last. There's no way that this administration is going to last. Whoever is going to wind up taking over is obviously going to hopefully set back the status quo where the Republican Party, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic about this, is going to basically backslide into their traditional God, guns, and, you know, I wrote it in the book, but I forget what Republicans used to be about is, you know, God, guns, and conservatism.
Yeah, in the book you wrote God, guns, and fear.
Basically, yeah. And so I started working on that, and it was a real, as I finished the final, you know, the semi-final edits for Camphor Press, which made them say, okay, we like this, we will publish this, right around, I think it was December of 2019. Then 2020 happened. You remember 2020? What a weird year that was, where we all were inside of our houses and it's still happening right now. Anyway, I digress. But right around, you know, I started doing the final edits, the back and forth between myself and the publisher, right around 3-4 weeks before the election. And it became, although at the time it definitely looked like what eventually happened did happen, what eventually was going to happen happened, the publisher was like, you realize if he whose name we will not mention gets reelected, this whole book is not going to make any sense anymore. And I said, yeah, you know what? That's going to be the least of our problems.
You had a lot riding on that.
I had a lot
in many ways. Well, I guess the whole country did.
But the one thing that I changed nothing insofar as like, okay, I am going to visualize that this book takes place sometime in, we'll call it the current administration, give or take, and that the right wing is trying to retake power by basically leaping onto an issue that both the, you know, progressives and right wingers can agree on, which I believe is going to be, oh, China is doing bad things again. And I think that we're actually seeing that in the real world, and that, you know, and I don't touch on this specifically in the book, but, you know, that, that people who are for 10, 20 years have been like, oh, free Tibet. Now they're also like, oh, look what's going on in Xinjiang. Look what's going on to the Uyghurs there. And you're getting a lot more agreement from, let's say, the left and the right on, you know, what China is doing that may not necessarily be a good thing for the world in general. And so that, although I present it as a very humorous thing in my book, it's that this person, Rinpoche Schwartz, has been kidnapped by the Chinese, and this is why Republicans are coming out for him and Democrats are coming out for him. That in some ways, you know, there are other issues that are also happening that, because the book is a comedy, I'm touching on briefly, but I'm leaving that to the readers to sort of think about themselves. I want this, this book exists in a kinder, gentler universe, but definitely a post that guy universe. But yeah, I'm sorry, I've digressed again. The one thing that I changed is there was an original line, which was, this is from the Badger News Network, coming up next. Was Madam President actually a madam? One Oklahoma pastor says he has proof. So I changed that line to, was Madam Vice President actually a madam, coming up next? And the reason was, at that time, I felt like, okay, it's definitely going to be Biden and Harris, and I don't want to like put like bad mojo into this. I want to wish the best for President Biden and Vice President Harris. So I was happy to say this book takes, when this book takes place, although I never mentioned the president by name, when this book takes place, the president who, as we know, was elected in 2020 is still alive and well, and his vice president is still Madam Vice President.
The Republicans are the minority party in the book. I still found it your imagining of this post-former guy political environment, and you call him the host in the book. Still remarkably prescient. It's the triumph of spin and lies over facts, which is a major theme of the book. And really, just yesterday, today, what we're seeing now in Texas, millions without power or clean water in the freezing cold, while one of their senators went to Cancun and came back.
And they're saying, oh, this is the Green New Deal.
Exactly.
That caused all this, which the unfortunate thing is, if they say it enough times, it's there. Do you watch Big Mouth? You like the cartoon Big Mouth?
Oh, I don't know it, but I know that was a big part of Goering's philosophy or strategy in Nazi Germany, was just repeating the lie over and over again, and people believe it.
But the other thing is, I think that they zoom in on it a little bit more. And I think that they zoom in on, I mean, I don't think that Goering could have imagined the internet, the way that the internet works now. I'm sure he would have had a field day with it. He would have figured out how to use it to his advantage very quickly. But the line from Big Mouth is, there's a character who's a sleazy lawyer, and he and his son say, I said it and you're thinking about it. And that's all that matters.
You're listening to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood on KABU Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Joshua Samuel Brown, author of the debut novel, Spinning Karma, published by Camphor Press.
So now you've got people who are like, wait a minute, could the Green New Deal be responsible for this power outage in Texas, as if that's A, possible, since the Green New Deal is just a bunch of words at this point. It's not actually...
It's not a law, yes.
It's not been instituted in any way, shape, or form, whereas the things that have been happening to Texas's power grid, and I'm no expert, but I think it's safe to say that whatever condition that Texas's power grid is in currently as of mid-February 2021 is the result of things that have happened to it over the last 20 years, and not because of a potential law or philosophy that hasn't even come to pass yet. It's more likely.
Well, it's actually goes back a lot farther than that, where they actually privatized their power providers. There's an Eastern grid that was set up in the U.S., a Western grid the only part of Texas that's part of one of these two grids, El Paso, part of the Western grid, they actually have power right now, and the residents are having no problems. So you can see that decision kind of led to the current crisis many years, decades, before the Green New Deal.
Does reality actually matter? I mean, and that's the hard question. Does it matter? You know that. I know that. All it takes is literally 5 minutes of thought to really come to this conclusion. But also, hey, windmills are responsible for this. Hey, did you hear that windmills are? I heard that windmills are responsible. I heard a guy who said that windmills are responsible. There are 5,000 people on Twitter in the last hour saying windmills are responsible. Jeez. Maybe windmills are responsible. See that? I mean,
yeah. The other another thing, Josh, about the Prussians, what you kind of foresaw. There's a right wing congresswoman in the novel, plays a big part. Her name in the novel is Heather Hoffman. She's from Rinpoche Schwartz's district in Colorado. You write that after the host presidency ended, and of course that's the fictional former guy. Exactly. Her party. You have this quote. Her party, the Republican Party, reverted to the classic, if somewhat nebulous, God, guns, fear, which we mentioned platform,
right,
that had carried them far during the previous century. Actually, that's been kind of the Republican strategy for many years. Hoffman fit the mold perfectly. She'd come into power wrapped in an American flag, Bible in one manicured hand, and hunting rifle in the other, which I thought, you know, it's a fairly accurate description of a real-life Colorado congresswoman now, Lauren Boebert, who actually was instrumental in the January 6th insurrection, and she's facing all sorts of legal problems. Hopefully she'll be expelled. But you couldn't have known about her. She's a freshman representative when writing the book.
And here's the truth. When I originally wrote this, I sort of wanted an amalgamation between like Michelle Bachmann, Sarah Palin, you know, but the thing is, I wanted to make this character so over the top that nobody would say, oh, this character actually, this is based on a real live person, because look at how over the top this person is. But the problem is, they keep setting the bar for over the top higher and higher and higher, to the point where, at this point, my character of, Congresswoman Hoffman, she'd almost be a centrist in today's Republican Party.
Yes, whereas certainly to the left of Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, representative from Georgia.
And I knew nothing about either of these two people when I wrote the book, nor did I know it when I edited it. Now I do know, and I'm like, oh my goodness, you know.
Now, you also have fun. You mentioned the Badger News Network, which is, of course, Badger.
It's not based on any. It's based on it badgers people. It's not based on any news organization.
Nothing to do with Fox or so I won't even make that connection.
I've never heard. Is that Rush Limbaugh just passed away. Very sorry. I'm sorry. Where was I?
Well, you could pay your respects if you'd like, but you got to keep the language clean.
No respects to pay, thank you. But yeah, definitely this right-wing news network is certainly something that's been a part of the American discourse and dialogue for 25 years. And the thing is that when I initially started writing this, I was afraid that the way that I portrayed these people was too exaggerated. It's too slapstick, because nobody would ever have a show called Shut Up with Chuck O'Donnell.
And you have a fictional show in the book on this Badger News Network, and that sounds like a Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson type of host.
Except Bill O'Reilly is interesting in that I think that Bill O'Reilly may be like, whoa, these other guys are a little bit too crazy for me. Bill O'Reilly is...
Well, he got fired from Fox, all right? He was asked to leave.
Of the three names that you just named, Bill O'Reilly, Tucker Carlson, and Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly would be the most progressive, the most reasonable of these three characters. And I believe that Chuck O'Donnell certainly would be far more reasonable. Somebody I'd rather sit down and, you know, I guess I'd eat a steak, a bloody red steak with him, over either Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity. Yeah. So, and that's the thing, is that initially my idea was he's going to be this blowhard. And now it's like, oh my God, he's actually kind of subtle compared to a lot of the guys who are now out there.
And then, of course, you were fair and balanced in the book, Josh. You also have a daytime talk show called Listen to Us, which is very NPR, and it's on this fictional American public radio network. And the show and the network love giving away tote bags, so we kind of know.
Listen to Us with Sing Roy.
Listen to Us. I mean, it's so polite. It's so nice. Yeah. And this kind of playing both sides here with the media gives you free rein to explore spin in all its forms, from the media personalities, both on the right and the left, to political figures like the fictional Colorado representative, but you also have a Chinese envoy, and of course the
Guo Kaixing, who I think I love that character so much because he's just trying to do what's best for everybody.
He's very likable. You're right.
Well, his name is Guo Kaixing. Kaixing is happy.
See, and I didn't get that because I don't speak Kaixing. Mandarin.
there's a lot of in Chinese jokes in there, but his name is Kaixing or Gaoxing, Kaixing. Han Kaixing is very happy. I don't want to spoil anything, but you know, I think he does his best.
Yeah. Well, when you mentioned that, a major part of the plot, of course, in Spinning Karma is the right relationship between the two Chinas, so Taiwan and the People's Republic of China, or mainland okay. China, or just Taiwan, China.
Taiwan and China, for sure.
But also the U.S. And we learn in the book that, and I didn't know this, that dating from President Carter's administration, there's no official U.S. embassy in Taiwan.
This is correct.
They have a trade institute there, Institute.
AIT, American Institute in Taiwan.
And of course, that's the de facto embassy. Yeah, so it's kind of like a not so secret embassy just to appease the Chinese. You use the relationship to comic effect in the book, but it must be a cause of great concern and anxiety to the people of Taiwan, where they don't know what China's going to be up to next.
And that's the other thing. And I hope that this comes out in the book, certainly. And this has been a major thing in a lot of my writing, especially my nonfiction writing about Taiwan. People in Taiwan do not wake up in the morning, have their coffee, and then huddle worrying, what's China going to do today? They don't. They live their lives. And it's as much a facet of their lives as earthquakes. In fact, actually, probably less, because there are more earthquakes that affect them regularly there. China is definitely a part of the Taiwanese psyche insofar as, yes, this is an issue that has been hanging over our heads for quite some time. It doesn't look like something that's going to be resolved, but it's something that we have to keep at arm's length and keep dealing with. But it is not a major thing that people think about. It's not a subject of conversation all the time. Once a year they do this thing, and it's a really fun time to be in Taiwan if you ever get a chance. They do their annual air raid drill where everybody's got to get off the street for an hour. And it's super cool. And they announce it firsthand.
Wow, like a duck and cover in the 60s or something like that?
Yeah, but what they do is everybody, basically there's the alarm goes off and everybody has to go, either they have to stay inside, you can go into the subways, you can do all sorts of things. But then they just have, and they're very polite about it because the Taiwanese are super polite. I hope that comes out in my book, how polite the Taiwanese are. But either they're like, okay, everybody has to get off the street, and then you just hang out in the train station. And the idea is to just see how quickly everybody can get off the street in the event that, you know, there were to be an air raid. And I've been through lots of them, and it's always a lot of fun because Taiwan, especially Taipei, is this insanely crowded city. But then everybody goes out and they take their pictures and they hang out their windows. And it's like, oh, this is Zhongshan Beilu, and there's nobody on the street, you know. So it's kind of cool. But I guess my point is that, yeah, the American Institute in Taiwan is just a facet of life in Taiwan. They consider it to be the embassy. But it does everything that an embassy does. There's nothing that an embassy does that that American Institute in Taiwan doesn't do. It is a trade office. They do a lot of things. They've just got a brand new building. So it is, for all intents and purposes, an embassy.
Now, I'd like to talk a little about your literary influences in your nonfiction work. And I think we talked about this before. There's a more than a touch of Hunter S. Thompson and even of William S. Burroughs, who's name checked in a previous book, used the term Interzone, which was one of his books. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Rinpoche Schwartz's son is named Burroughs in the novel.
Yes.
And in Spinning Karma, you have the lead character, Mr. Schwartz, quote another great writer, Kurt Vonnegut, "A peculiar travel suggestions are dancing lessons from God," which I looked up. It's from Cat's Cradle. And I see Vonnegut's influence in the comedy and also the humanity in your novel, which Vonnegut was just a master at, and also the short chapters, which you had mentioned to me previously that that was a part of the book as a kind of a present to the reader.
I wanted something that was, and this goes back to it originally having been a screenplay. I wanted it to be episodic, and I wanted it to build up to a comedic crescendo, and I wanted it to be something that somebody could pick up and read on a flight from, I'll just pick two places, let's say Portland, Oregon to Taipei.
I was thinking Houston to Cancun, but
I don't think that he's my, although fun fact, Ted Cruz does have a copy of Formosa Moon. Perhaps he was reading that on the plane. I don't think so. I did give a copy of Formosa Moon to Ted Cruz's liaison when he came to Taiwan. Very nice guy, by the way. And I said, thank you for supporting Taiwan. But, you know, I wanted something that was going to be short and episodic. And honestly, Vonnegut is one of those writers who at any given point, I have almost all of his books on my Kindle. If I'm on an airplane flight and there's nothing good on, you know, on the various channels that they have and I can't sleep, I can at any point open up any Vonnegut novel and read the thing cover to cover at this point in 3 to 6 hours on a flight and still enjoy it, still get things out of it that I didn't get out of it before, still laugh at the jokes, and it still remains fresh for me.
Do you have a favorite Vonnegut novel?
Recently, yes. Honestly, the truth is that Slaughterhouse-Five is my favorite book. However, recently I've become a big fan of God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, which I read again before I started my new job. I work, I don't know if I want to talk about my job, so I'm not going to talk about it, but I work at a call center, and it's a call center where people who are in a lot often in a bad place in their life where they need help, they need assistance. And, you know, I answer their calls. And I remember how, you know, Mr. Rosewater always answered the phone, you know, thank you for calling the Rosewater Foundation. How can I help you? How can I help you? And the thing is, he was the only guy there. And sometimes it would be 3 a.m. and somebody would call and they were screaming because there's a mouse in their house or something, but he's always super nice to people on the phone. So in that way, Elliot Rosewater. No, Elliot Rosewater is the father. I
can't correct you on that because I haven't read that book in a while. But in addition to literary influences, I want to talk a little bit about your comedy influences too. Not that Vonnegut's not very funny.
Vonnegut's very funny. But look, I was aiming for a Vonnegut-length novel with this, and I think that I got that.
Oh, no. In fact, it has a nice momentum to it, where you keep reading. I mean, I want to keep reading because it's almost, a Vonnegut novel works like that, but Hitchcock works like that too. It's kind of some guy gets caught up. He's somewhat involved in getting caught up in a mess. Some of it's his doing, some of it's not. And then it just kind of snowballs from there. And that's how your novel's plot works. So you just want to keep kind of finding out what's going to happen next. Now, in terms of the comic references, there's at least two that I caught, Monty Python and the Coen Brothers, Big Lebowski specifically. And I know you're a big Firesign Theater fan.
Huge.
Was any of that kind of an influence when you were writing the novel?
I don't know if it was influence. It wasn't in the front of my mind, but it's certainly all of that stuff is in the back of my mind. So, for example, the line, help, we're being oppressed, that it was help, we're being repressed. That wasn't like I was swiping that from it was Holy Grail that that's from. Help, help, we're being repressed. The Big Lebowski thing, the reason that I use that is because you've got this guy, he's talking to somebody from Badger News Network. He is clearly of a more left-wing bent. I describe him as having long hair, and he has a sign that says free to bet. And he gives a fairly complicated answer to the guy on Badger News who clearly wants a soundbite. So he just gives him the soundbite of "this aggression will not stand, man." But that's, of course, that's Lebowski. But right. That's Lebowski also, that's George W. Bush. Or H.W. Bush, sorry.
Oh, yeah, that was the Iraq War.
Something that had already entered into the public vernacular before the Coen brothers used it. So that was even a reference to that.
The main American Buddhists in the novel are both Jewish. There's the protagonist, Rinpoche Schwartz, right. Eddie Schwartz, and his teacher, Julius Jacob Shmulowitz, whose spiritual name is Baba Avigi.
One of his spiritual names.
And then you have the book dedicated to a real life Baba Ramdas, who was born into a Jewish family and became an atheist and then later embraced Buddhism, but also later Judaism as Richard, when he was originally born as Richard Alpert. Mm-hmm. And you were also born into a Jewish family.
Yes.
What do you see as the appeal of Buddhism for Western Jews, maybe for you personally?
It seems like it is a natural transition. And I don't know why, because, you know, as Jews, we're born to think of this all-powerful, omnipotent sky god who somehow has chosen us for something, even though history does not necessarily back this up. We've got to keep believing in this god and do a whole bunch of things, starting with cutting the tips of our penises off, obviously having a professional do that. And, you know, not mixing milk and meat and keeping dietary habits. And then the other thing about Judaism, and I'm not a Judaic scholar, nor do I play one on television. I don't think that they have any idea about, like, you know, the afterlife. It's just
I asked a friend of mine who's a rabbi. Apparently there's nothing.
It's very, very vague.
Yeah, that's actually in a holy book or something. It's just a whole bunch of commentaries.
Sure.
Speculation. Yeah. It's like speculative fiction, I guess. Speculative spiritualism.
Buddhism. So Judaism is like, you have to follow these rules and lead a good life because this is what G-D wants you to do. And is there a reward for it? Maybe, but you should still do it anyway. Maybe, yes, possibly. Let's not talk about that until the time comes. Whereas Buddhism is, okay, there is a way that you should live and there's a way to live within, you know, following these precepts. And at the end of your life, you will be reborn. And basically, and again, nor am I a Buddhist scholar, nor do I play one on television, but my understanding is that your rebirth will be based on partially what you've done in this life. Have you done good
things?
Your
spinning karma.
Exactly. And I like to think that what Buddhism gives to me, and I do consider myself a Buddhist. I meditate. I've gone on many meditation retreats. For once upon a time, I practiced Vipassana meditation, and I would force anybody who I knew who would listen to me for more than 20 minutes on the subject, you got to go do this 10-day hardcore Vipassana meditation. And I made my brother Seth do it. You can ask him about it. But let's just say that not everybody who I gave that advice to who followed through on it thanked me for it afterwards, because it's a very hardcore form of meditation, Buddhism, but Vipassana. But and that's why in my book I weaponize Vipassana. I don't know if that's correlation, but in any event, the idea is that if you behave in a certain way, there is some sort of ecosystem where you will then be reborn, and your soul will be reborn to learn lessons that you still need to learn. And eventually, when you learn all those lessons, then you escape the cycle of rebirth. Though in my case, I'm not hoping to do that. I just want to be reborn on another planet. That's what I'm working on, because I'm not ready. I still like life a lot. I've just seen a lot of this planet. It's great. It's, you know, much respect to the planet Earth. I just think there are a lot of other planets out there with maybe lower gravities and maybe two or three suns that I could check out for a while.
Hey, I saw some cool pictures of Mars today.
Oh, yeah. Now that looks cool. There's no life on Mars, though. So we're talking like other star systems. But in any event, Buddhism puts together, I don't have the proper words, but my feeling is why you should behave in a certain way, and it's not supposed to be reward or punishment, but rather, oh, if you behave in a good way and you exhibit compassion and you live a compassionate life, your next rebirth could possibly be one that is, I don't know what it's going to be. I have no idea. This is where it all falls apart for me. But I do like to think, we mentioned Rush Limbaugh earlier. As a Buddhist, my first thought was, oh, I hope he rots in hell, because people were saying that. But then I thought, no, I hope that he is reborn into a form that teaches him compassion. So
that's very Buddhist.
That is very Buddhist. But whether that is, oh, maybe right now there is a baby being born who is in a poor, impoverished family, somebody who is not a white American, who is being reborn, who now is going to need to experience compassion. And I hope that they get that compassion to teach that soul something so that they can move on. And I don't know how it works. I'm just hoping that, because it's better to think good thoughts than to think bad thoughts in general. I think that that's been proven. But Buddhism does tend to attract, I think that it attracts Jews. And I also think that, as I've mentioned, Baba Avijee, and I think that Ram Dass himself, he talks about this. I listen to Ram Dass's podcast a lot. And he also talks about his use of psychedelic substances. I think that if you have some sort of, you know, upbringing in a semi-spiritual household or community, and then you throw psychedelics into the mix, it will lead you to Buddhism. I think that that leads you to that.
Now, one last question.
Or you go Meshuggah, or you just go Meshuggah.
Yeah, and that's Meshuggah. You have that in the book there. You kind of mix up the Pali and the from Hindu and Sanskrit.
That is the road to Dukkha. Right. Or you just go Meshuggah.
Yeah. Now, one last question. We actually met at KBOO Radio several years ago. We were both writing and producing radio theater pieces for a show called The Ubu Hour from Rolf Semperbon. It was a groundbreaking show. Rolf, by the way, if you're listening, you still owe us for the ground that you broke. You know, it's
yes, please come over and fix it.
You break it, you buy it. And then
also, Rolf, if you're listening, that when I wrote the part of Chuck O'Donnell, I thought about you. And you'll have to read the book, why it is that I would want you to play him in a radio presentation of this. Rolf, do you agree that Rolf would be perfect?
Rolf would be perfect for any of the characters, I think.
Rolf has it.
Well,
I'm not sure for my Taiwanese women characters, but go on.
Okay. After the radio theater pieces, you started your own show, Puppet Radio Theater, which ran about 2 years. I kept thinking while reading Spinning Karma, how it would work as a radio theater production, which you're perfectly capable of doing. Is that something you have any plans to return to in the near or distant future?
Yes, radio theater, and that's one of the things. When we close on this house, knock wood, we will be, I mean, you know, Twilight and I, we do comedy, and we want to do comedy. And when we were in Taiwan, we would always talk, oh, we really got to get back to doing comedy. But she was getting her master's degree, and I was doing a job and everything like that. It is something that we want to do in the future, and I think that podcasting is probably the way to go. For Spinning Karma, we are already talking about an audiobook version with one of my favorite podcasters is Laszlo Montgomery of the China History Podcast. And he was my first thought to do this audiobook version. And I've asked him to do it, and we're in negotiations for it, but I think he's going to wind up doing the audiobook version. He's got a great voice. I don't know if we've talked about China History Podcast, right?
Oh yeah, but I haven't listened to it.
He's got a great voice. He's got a voice that I want to be these characters. And also, he, like me, is a Jewish person who gravitated to, you know, in my case, Taiwan, in his case, China, but I've also lived in China. And he speaks fluent Chinese. His Chinese is amazing. His pronunciation is, oh my God, that's awesome. And he knows, I like to say that he's forgotten more about China than I have ever known. And I know more about just Chinese history and minutiae than most people, even most Chinese people, because I've studied this sort of thing. So that's kind of something that I want to happen.
Well, we look forward to that, Josh. And again, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KBOO Community Radio, or KBOO Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big neighborhood thank you to our guest today, Joshua Samuel Brown, author of the debut novel Spinning Karma, published by Camphor Press. You can find out more about Josh's new book and all his work on his website, josambro.com. That's josambro.com. Just a note that Mr. Jones's Neighborhood comes to you monthly on every fourth Friday from 11 a.m. to noon. Tune in for our next show on Friday, March 26th at 11 a.m. It will be spring. And if our plans come through, we'll be welcoming a very special guest, one of my audio comedy heroes, perhaps yours as well, and a major reason why I got into radio, but please don't hold that against him. Hope to see you all again then. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, may it always be a beautiful day in your neighborhood.